Hello, welcome to the Long Shot Leaders Podcast. I'm Michael Stein. My guest today is Gina Cazzazza. Oh man, Gina was one heck of an interview. Really interesting. She lost hearing in one ear for 10 years, and how she got it back and what she did to get there is very interesting. She's also a stand-up comedian. She's also worked in the film industry. She also has, she's only 5 feet tall. She's trained with Navy SEALs. And she's also trained with a special type of camp or service up in Big Bear to, she paid them to kidnap her so she can have more experience if she's kidnapped. Yes, you heard that right. I usually only spend about 35 minutes talking to somebody and try to encapsulate everything. But if they're a really good raconteur and if they keep on coming up with things that I don't want to leave open-ended, I'll go a little longer. She was so intriguing. I went a little longer than usual, but I really think you're going to find this interesting. How she, you know, maneuvered her way out of certain situations and how she kept on fighting to get her hearing back and how she puts herself in situations to improve herself. I just thought it was fascinating. You know, once she got really going, it was really funny to talk to her. Just had a really good time. Here is Gina Cazzazza.
All right. I'm here with Gina Cazzazza. I say Cazzazza. But anyways, I love your story. We're just talking in the pregame. We're talking about like entrepreneurship and stand-up comedy, and she's into film. She just wrote a book. I love it. And then we're going to get into how you paid someone to kidnap you. I think I don't know. I don't want to reveal anything. I want to go in origin. I always go, we go in story, origin story. So from Long Island, yeah. Tell us about childhood. You have to have some kind of weird ass shit that, unless you're Jerry Seinfeld, that why you wanted to be a stand-up comedian. Let's get into it.
No, you know, it's weird. Everyone's like, when you're a comic, you must have had like a broken childhood. No, I had an amazing childhood. I grew up with amazing parents and my life was fantastic. I really had no struggles in that. The one awesome thing about my parents that I think is also really rare is like they encouraged failure, and they also had this rule where if you start something, you can't finish it. I mean, you can't quit. You have to finish it until the end of the season, which I think is really amazing because when you start something new, it's a struggle and it's hard. So you want to quit right away. You're like, this is miserable and not fun. But if you stick it out to the whole entire season, whether you like it or don't like it, you see improvement. Right. And then you like find out like, oh, I actually really liked it. I just didn't like the struggle. And nobody likes the struggle. Like I mean, maybe some people are like, I love the struggle. I mean, for me, no, I much rather have an easy life where things just come to me. But unfortunately, that's not real life. So I learned at such an early age, like how to fail and how to struggle and how to get back in it and, you know, take my licks and get up. So I think that's what kind of made me go into the creative world, because the creative world is a world that normal people just won't do. Like there's no stability. There's no income on an everyday basis. There's no health insurance. It's terrifying and scary. And I think that's one of the reasons why I am still in it.
what did they do for a living that they were so, they sound like entrepreneurs? What did they do?
No, my dad was, and still is, he's an electrician and he's like a total blue collar guy. Like he can fix anything. It's kind of amazing. And my mom was a mom. She dabbled in a bunch of stuff where she like did travel agency and did health coaching and did a few things here and there, but her main job was to be a mom. And it really like rubbed off on me. And, you know, my dad was very into like working hard and all that. So that kind of, you know, played a part into my life.
Brothers and sisters, well, any of those?
Two brothers. They're both younger than me. One is 13 months apart and the other one is 7 months apart, 7 years apart.
One. Were you the more responsible one because you're the oldest?
Me and my brother are only 13 months apart. So we're very similar. And I'd say he's more the jolt. Okay. I'm more like everything's a joke. I'm the comic. Yeah. And he's more serious. So sometimes people might think he's older than me, but I'm actually older.
Okay. Unconventional there too. Usually the youngest is like the comedian and all that. So then school, were you a good student?
Great student for a teacher. Like I didn't bother you. I did my work. I never missed a homework. I was not great in test taking. So, you know, I failed a lot, but I was a great student in terms of, you know, showing up, doing the work.
Were you nervous to take the test? Is that what did it?
I just couldn't comprehend the questions. I struggled with comprehension, which means I wasn't listening in class. That's really what comprehension is. You know, it's like, it's just a fancy way of me saying I didn't pay attention.
Copy that. What'd you do after high school? Did you go to college? What'd you do then?
Yeah. So, okay. So back up a tad to, I didn't pay attention. So when I was in school, when I was in middle school, I wanted to be a creative, like I wanted to be a singer. I was 12. So I started like writing my own music and making a music video. And I sent it out to like Virgin Atlantic. Like I am being from Long Island. My mom took me to like see all the Broadway shows. And I remember seeing Joey Fatone in Rent, and I brought my demo tape and I handed it to him. And I was like, this is it. I'm going to get the phone call. I never got the phone call, but I started there. And then I became super shy and super introverted. And in high school, I became like the girl that didn't speak. Like if you called on me or something, I was just like, no. So in ninth grade, my social studies teacher made us make a movie that we had to act in. And we had to like pick someone from history out of a hat. And then we had to learn about them and create a movie. Yeah. And I was like, can I not do this? Like, I can't be in front of the camera. I was like terrified. And he was like, sorry, like gotta do it. And I ended up doing it. And at the time it was in ROTC. So I kind of recruited my ROTC people and I like filmed them. And I had a bunch of guy cousins and I filmed all them kind of in war and battle. And I made this cool movie and my grandpa was an editor. So he edited weddings and stuff. So I learned from him and I loved it. I hated the acting part, but I loved the making the movie part. And my teacher was like, this is the best thing I've ever seen. And I was like, that's it. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go into the movie business. I'm going to be a director, like 100%. And then when I was in senior year of high school, you got to decide like if you knew what you wanted to be in life, you could go to a technical school. Mm-hmm. So I ended up going to a film school. So half the day I went to regular school and then the other half I went to film school. Was top of my class in that one. I paid attention and I ended up graduating with a scholarship and I went to Hunter College. I didn't want to go to college, but my parents really wanted me to get an education because as a creative, you know, a degree was nice to fall back on at the time. Right. So I ended up going to Hunter. I hated it. I hated it so much. It was terrible, but you know, I wasn't paying. So whatever, I just showed up. And then I graduated early because I hated it so much.
You hated it so much. You studied hard so you could finish early.
I just wanted to get out. I was like getting out of here. I hate it.
Cool.
I ended up going to Argentina on a study abroad type of program, but it was only like 4 weeks. It was a month and it was during Christmas. At the time I got bronchitis when I was in Argentina and a bunch of other things happened. I was fine for 2 weeks, flew back to the United States and lost my hearing, went completely deaf in my left ear.
I heard about that. How did that happen?
They don't know. They only can assume that it's from bronchitis, and the virus still lingered in me. From studying it and understanding it more, there's also theories that due to me just going into the real world for the first time, graduating college, finding a job in the creative world, like I was just stressed out. And they said between the virus and stress and all that, it was just like shutting out the world. Like, I just was like, I'm done. I don't want to hear anybody. I don't want to hear anything.
So real quick, the ear thing wasn't mechanics. It was partial psychosomatic, or it really was mechanics.
They think it might be both. They think it, you know, could be due to, because here's what happened, which was interesting. So I remember going to get a hearing test, and I lost my hearing when I was in California visiting a friend. And my doctor calls me in from New York, and he was like, "What's going on?" And I was like, I don't know, my ear, something, it's just ringing. I don't know what's going on. It's just a really bad ringing. He's like, do not get on a plane, get to an ENT right now. Now, the day before that, before his phone call, I already went to the ER and they told me it's just fluid in my ear. It's fine. Like, here's some nasal spray. It's fine. My doctor was like, get to an ENT. It's more serious than that. For some reason that morning, I woke up and was like, something doesn't feel right. And I remember saying to my friend, what if they tell me I'm deaf? And he's like, they're not going to say that. I'm like, something doesn't feel right. And I went to do the hearing test. And after the test, the nurse walks in with a box of tissues. And she's like, I'm so sorry to tell you that you're completely deaf in your left ear. Your hearing's gone. And I was like, how I get it back? Like, as tears are like welling up in my eyes. And she's like, you already lost it for 1 week. It's called sudden hearing loss. You have one more week to get it back. The chances are 50-50. And I just remember looking at her and be like, I'm going to be that 50-50 chance. Yeah. And it's like the worst day, like, because then I ended up like trying to get the meds. I'm calling my parents. I'm hysterically crying. My dad's like a really like tough dude where he's like, and my mom's like the nurturer, you know, and my mom's like trying to figure out, and I'm the girl that cried wolf. So I used to make up stories as a kid in the creative world, like, you know, and I used to be like, I remember like trying to keep my mom on the phone when I was like coming home from college on the train, cause like 2 hour ride, and she'd have to go. And I'd be like, no, you don't understand. Like, a homeless man just stole my sandwich. And she's like, what do you mean? And now she's involved in the story, but I'm lying the whole time, you know? So like I'm kind of like that. Yeah. So when I'm like saying I'm deaf to my brother to put my mom on the phone, like no one's believing it at the time. Yeah. And then I'm on the, then my mom gets me on the phone and I'm hysterical. And now she knows something's wrong, cause I can't stop crying. And my dad's like, we can't even hear her, hang up until she learns to calm down. Like, and I'm like, love. I'm deaf. Like, what do you mean? And my dad's like, calm down, call me back. See ya. And I'm like pulling it together to call my parents to let them know, like, I lost my hearing. Yeah. And I end up, the place ends up shutting down, the medical place. Cause it was like, I was like the last patient of the day. I was borrowing my friend's car. I go to the car, the keys are missing. And I'm like, why? Where are the keys? So I'm like crying. I just learned I'm deaf. I lose my friend's car keys. And I have to break into this building now to try and find the keys. And I ended up like prying open the door. The lights were all shut off. I felt like I was like going to get kidnapped in this horror movie. And I have to go through now these doctor's drawers to try and find my keys. And I found them. And then I like ran out of there because I'm like, God only knows I like tripped an alarm system. Yeah. And that was my experience. And then I will tell you, like, I ended up getting a job on Dancing with the Stars, like 2 weeks after that. I flew back to New York and I'm laying on the couch.
This is so random. It's so like so discursive.
You didn't know we were going to go this way.
No, that's great. Real quick. Where was the ear, nose and throat doctor? I'm just curious where you broke
it. It was in Santa Barbara, California.
Okay. A nice place too. Okay. Go on. So yeah. 2 weeks later now, wait, after the first week, though, before you get to the Dance with the Stars, they said you got 1 week. You didn't get it back.
So they gave me a bunch of steroids. Nothing worked. And I remember like being home. Well, I come home. I said to myself, it was a Friday. And I said, you have until Monday to wallow. So get it all out, cry. And on Monday, we're going to work. We're going to get this hearing back. And that's the mission. So I gave myself a weekend pity party, and Monday I got to work and I called up the next ENT and I was like, some ENT has to give me some form of hope. And during that time as I'm doing all that, my mom finds a job on Craigslist that's like looking for like a TV show, looking for an assistant for the week. It was like $750. And my mom's like, you should apply. And I'm like, I'm going through things right now. I'm not applying for anything. Like, I'm taking the semester off. I graduated early. I'm not working. Like, I'm done. And she was like, no, no, it'd be so good for you. Just try it. It's just a week. And I ended up trying it. I mean, I ended up applying and it's Dancing with the Stars. And they hired me for their show. And my first celebrity, the celebrity I worked for was Ralph Macchio, who lives on Long Island.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, I barely was able to adjust to losing my hearing, and the whole entire job was hearing, because I had to like write down like what the dancer would say and what the celebrity would say. And they're both like, Ralph's in my deaf ear and Karina, the dancer's in my right ear. And I'm like, get, like, this isn't working, you know?
Right, right. This is an interesting time for you. First of all, if you're an Italian girl from Long Island, and you know, you're working with Ralph Macchio, who's from Long Island, that's a big deal. Effort, you know, it's hard to describe unless you're from Long Island and you're Italian, especially. You don't have to be like Ralph Macchio, but that's, this is, and now you got this ear thing going on. I get it. Go on.
Yeah. And well, and the thing is, I met Ralph, he came to my film school, you know, X amount of years ago. And I'm a huge Outsider fan. And Ralph, you know, the guy doesn't age. So he looks like he was Johnny Cade in The Outsiders. And I'm just having this starstruck moment. And I can't stop asking him questions about the movie. And I'm like, I was working so hard to hear that I just went back to crying. That's just the thing I do. I just went back to crying. And I was like, I don't know if I'm gonna be able to make it in the film industry. Like, I can't hear. And nobody in the film industry or in any industry that's fast paced and wants to repeat themselves. Nobody wants to help you. Nobody cares. Nobody cares about your disability. It's all about you overcoming that and, you know, not being an issue or whatever.
Right.
So I ended up finishing. The job went great. They really liked me. And I stayed in touch with Dancing with the Stars for a year. And I then called them and a year later and was like,
wait, real quick.
Yeah.
What's going on with the ear?
So
a whole year? When you make this call, the ear's still not working?
Ear's still not working.
After a
year.
Well, how, I gotta ask, like, you know, you
10 years. It took 10 years to get my hearing.
Well, let's talk about the first year. Year one, before you make that call, I want to get to where we're at right now.
Yeah.
You start talking to yourself. You're like, yeah, it was good. You know, I got the one here. That's going to be okay. You come at peace with it or something. Or how are you dealing with it? The loss of hearing in the one ear.
I'm learning to adjust. I will say there was a lot of hard moments. You forget that you're half deaf. Like, it's just not, you just don't. I forget that I'm hearing and then I forget that I'm deaf. It's like, you know, and I remember being in the Apple store and I was just like, you know, like when you play on the computers while you're in the Apple store, you know, I was waiting for a friend.
Yeah.
And one of the people comes up to me in my, like, behind me, but on my left side.
Yeah.
And I can't see them. I'm playing on the computer and they're asking me if I need any help. And they kept asking like 3 times. And then they just walked away annoyed. And my friend comes up to me and goes, why? I believe it was a male. He's like, were you so rude to him? And I was like, what are you talking about? And he was like, he kept asking you questions. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm deaf. That's why. Like, I forgot like that. I'm like, and then sometimes when I'm in the airport and I just would put headphones in one ear. What do I need the other one for? You know, and people would come up to me, ask me questions sometimes. And they don't realize, like, I'm not being rude. I just can't hear you. Like, it's a thing.
Got it. So are you proactively trying to help yourself with the ear during this period? Or you said, nah, that's it. Been
whole
good.
Time. I went to over 4 ENTs. I even flew back to California. Okay. Funny story. I flew back to California to Dr. House, the number one ENT in the world, is in California.
Your nose and throat doctor, like, ladies and gentlemen, yeah.
And I went to 4 ENTs. They shot steroids in my ear. Nothing was happening. I was taking hearing tests weekly Then I took week tests monthly because it was not good for my psyche of, you know, being let down. I was like, I'm hearing. And then I'm, you know, yeah. It really wasn't. It was my imagination. So I flew to California. I'm like, this guy's my last hope. The number one ENT in the world. Like, he has to help me.
This is after the phone call. I want to get to the phone call, but I'm like, how far into the deafness is this guy?
I guess like a year or so.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. Because what happened was is I also then, I believe I planned it around the same. I ended up flying back to California. I wanted to recreate the moment of when I lost my hearing because I lost it in California.
Interesting.
And I was in Cheesecake Factory. I had these two drinks. I had these two appetizers. I remember everything, where we were sitting. And I just watched too many movies and I was just like, I got to just try. So I recreated that night because I was like the same time, the same Cheesecake Factory, all that stuff. I showed up at to see if maybe like after the meal, my hearing would restore, you know, like they did. Yeah. That doesn't happen.
No, you never know.
I tried.
You're like me. You see too many movies. You're like romanticizing your circumstance. I get it.
I did. I tried. I was like, I put my wish in the fountain. It's Cheesecake Factory. I did everything. And then I saw Dr. House and he was like, give it up. It's never going to happen. And I just remember just being like, I won't give up. I'm not doing it. Like, but every part of me wanted to, and there were moments where I did stop. Like I just went on with my life and then things would keep showing up in my life that would bring me back into the whole find your hearing journey. And like I said, it was a 10-year journey. And while I'm journeying through this, I'm also working in the creative business
Let's get back to that phone call. Because I interrupted you, but I just had to know the details. So this phone call a year later after Dancing with the Stars.
Yes. Yes. Then they said they have another celebrity, Sherry Shepherd, and she was in New York City on The View. And she's so funny. And they said, can you come and work for her for the week on the show? And I said, of course. So I went and I did that. And then they go, they said it was a Monday and they go, we'll give you Thursday off. Can you move here by Sunday to Los Angeles and come and work for us for the rest of the season?
Yeah.
And I said, sure. So I, packed everything. And this is how supportive my parents were because I had no money. I had no job, no money. It was just, you know, I had this Dancing with the Stars gig, but the one thing that people don't understand in the film industry is that when a show ends, so does your job.
Right.
And there's no like, oh, I get more. No, that's it. It's all, you get some unemployment.
Collect unemployment for like 3 months, which is like such a common, it's like contacting the unemployment, you know, after a gig, you know, is like very common. And then you get the job and then unemployment again and back and forth. Yeah.
Yeah. That's it. You know, and it's just so inconsistent. So I said, okay. And I didn't have anything. I didn't have a home. I didn't have a car. I didn't have anything. So my mom, like Miss Researcher and like super nervous, her only daughter and, you know, firstborn is going 3,000 miles away, sheltered life, you know, where like I'm a bit naive and gullible. And I'm also 5 feet tall. And at the time I was under 100 pounds. So I looked very childlike. And she was like, oh my God, the last thing, like kidnapping, you know, she's thinking everything. So she helped me out with like getting me like a bed and breakfast. So it was a secure house that was very nice. And I ended up getting a rent a car and stuff. I ended up losing money working for them.
Right.
But I had this opportunity that money can't buy, you know, it was like, is a contact.
Yeah.
And after that ended, I flew back to New York because I wasn't getting an apartment. I was just working there for a bit. And then I ended up deciding to permanently move there. So that summer, it was like July. I was moving out in LA by July. And in August, I was going back to work for dancing. So at least I had a new job lined up and ready to go. And then Ralph calls me and says, hey, I'm directing a movie. It was called Across Grace Alley. I believe it's available on Netflix. It was a short film. He said, I'm looking for an assistant. Do you want to come be my assistant? It'll get you out of reality TV. It'll move you into a scripted world. And anyone that knows anything with film, that is a dream line to be getting out of reality and getting into a scripted business. That's what you want. Right. So
that's also what an independent film, Ralph Macchio aside, that's what an independent filmmaker will tell you. Because, but it's still a short film and it's going to go to a festival. It's not going to make any money and you're going to get paid low wages, but it's still an opportunity to work with, you know, Ralph Macchio, who's from Long Island and Italian, and he's like Mr. Outsiders. Got it.
Yeah. So I got to work for him. And he was the nicest, most amazing human being in the world. I remember he went to go and get coffee and he was like, Gina, can I get you anything? And I was like, isn't that my job? Like, I'm the assistant. And he was like, I have two hands. I have two arms. I'm perfectly capable of getting my own coffee. And I just remember being like, oh my God. Like, and then because I commuted 2 hours away, when it got late, and you know, movies, they go like 16-hour days. When it got late, like 9 o'clock, he was like, what are you doing here? Like, why are you still here? It's dark. Like, get out of here. And I'll be like, all right, I'll see you at 4 a.m. He's like, sleep, please. Like, you know, it was just really nice. He's like, I know you commute really like far from being here. So it's like, you don't get that. It was amazing. It was amazing. Right. And then I was like, I don't want to go back to dancing. I want to give it a shot in the scripted world. And my friend worked for White Collar. He was taking off for a week and he asked if I would come fill in. He worked in post. And I said, definitely. And then I made some connections there. Ended up getting a job working for Penny Marshall.
Oh, wow.
That was random. Got another job I found on Craigslist. And
wait, what'd you do? What happened on Craigslist? You got the Penny Marshall job from Craigslist?
I got dancing and Penny from Craigslist. I should send them a gift basket.
That tells you how long ago that was too.
Yeah.
Because that ain't happening now.
No. So I got that. And then I worked for her for a year and then I left. I was like, I'm done with this.
Yeah. From what I know, Penny Marshall, talented, can be challenging. And it's like the long drawl of like, the talking and it's like, really get to the point. Was it like that a little bit?
She was intense. So before me, she went through 5 assistants in a month. Yeah. Or I think it was less than that. Yeah. And then they found me and I just stuck because like she's from the Bronx and I'm from Long Island and you can't understand what she's saying. And I didn't even try. I was like, okay. And then.
And the ear's still not working. So you're like, still not working. Be a good thing. So,
okay, I don't care. And so we kind of jived. And I didn't bother her. Like when she was annoyed, I would be like, I'll talk to you tomorrow. Like everything that we had could wait. You know, she was Penny Marshall. Like no one needed, they were waiting on her. She's not waiting on anybody. Right. So it worked for me. And then I ended up, the guys from White Collar moved to this TV show called Wrecked, which was a pilot for TNT. They were doing the pilot. They asked if I would come to be the post PA. I was like, yes. Done. Ended up. Oh, let me back up for a hot second.
Yeah.
When I worked for Penny.
Yeah.
She told me and her brother, Gary, both told me different times that I should be an actress. That I should be in front of the camera.
Penny Marshall and Gary Marshall told you that you should be. High praise.
Yes. They said that I should be in front of the camera. And Penny was like, forget directing. Like anyone could be a director. Like, you know, it's so easy. You should act. You belong in front of the camera. Yeah. Sorry. It was like, no. And she goes, take an acting class. And Ralph mentioned I should take an acting class just like to be a better director a while ago. And then when Penny was like, take it, I was like, all right. So I ended up like going to a party and that night, I just randomly went to a party and I started talking to some guy and he ends up being an acting coach. And I was like, can I?
What was his name?
Jeff Solentano.
Okay.
And he ends up being an acting coach. So I joined his class and his class was like intense. It was so intense. And I hate it. I mean, I was ready to like leave like 16 times showing up. I was like, my stomach was in my throat. I was terrified. And then I had to actually act and I didn't know what I was doing. And then he like, you know, It's just, you feel so vulnerable when you're an actress, because you are, you're so vulnerable, and nobody likes to be vulnerable. Nobody likes to put themselves out there. We like these walls that we put up. So the fact that I had to shed all that and show up on this stage scared the living crap out of me. Right. I mean, it just did. And then when I finished, though, it was such a rush. I was like, ooh, this is terrifying and yet kind of exciting, because I just, I've come to realize that everything that you want in life is on the other side of fear. Everything that you want is on the other side of the uncomfortable. Right. And we are, like my Navy SEAL coach, the one that I was in this Navy SEAL program, maybe we'll get to it.
I want to get to there real quick too, but not right now. So wait. So you're going through, because you've always been you're still the shy girl. You're working through this, you know, you're going through the vulnerabilities, you're starting to open up. The hearing, one ear, still not there.
Gone. Still gone. And
what year is this now into the no hearing out in the acting class?
So maybe like 4 years into it.
4 years. Okay, go on.
Around that. And so like, so I'm like doing the acting and I decided to sign up. I said, all right, because it was like, you know, free class to try out. And then I said, all right, I'm going to do this. I'm going to commit. I'm being an actress. Not like be an actress. I said, I just wanted to get to a point in acting where I wasn't nervous to be up on that stage. Sure. Took me 6 months, every single class for 6 months. I never wanted to show up. I was ready to get in my car. I had to battle myself for 6 months. And then finally something happened. And I stopped battling myself and I showed up. I mean, I've always showed up. I mean, I just showed up vulnerable, ready to go. And I loved it. But the acting coach was very intense. And I wanted more non-intense. And I remember I was also going through like a hard time in terms of the creative world is very mentally draining and exhausting. You never know when you're going to make it. You never know when your shot's going to happen. You never know when your next job is. You don't know when the next paycheck's coming. It's all fear. It's all terrifying. It's, you know, and in my 20s, I mean, yes, I had amazing parents. I was never going to go homeless or hungry, but I also wanted to make it. I wanted to do it on my own. And I just remember like just being just sad, going like, what's going on? Like, what am I doing in my life? Where is it going? Where's this raise? Where's anything going? Yeah. And I started getting into like Wayne Dyer and his book.
Oh, yeah. Personal development guy. Yeah. Great guy. Yeah.
And I started listening to podcasts and all stuff. And suddenly I'm reading this book and I forgot which one it was. And he talked in the first page of the book about CST therapy, cranial sacral therapy. Mm-hmm. And as he talks about this cranial sacral therapy, he mentioned like how it healed someone and whatever. And I'm just thinking my hearing, like, and let me tell you, like from when I lost my hearing till now, anytime I heard something about hearing or healing, anything like that, I tried it, like hot yoga. Oh, hearing benefits. Also, I tried it. I did everything you could possibly imagine.
Chiropractor. Yeah.
Everything you can imagine. Right. So I said, oh, I never tried CST therapy. I don't even know what it was. But then I was like, okay, I let it go. And then one day I'm like laying on my couch and I open up my phone and there's a podcast episode about CST therapy. And I was like, oh, maybe this is my hint to look for a CST therapist.
Yeah.
I end up looking up a CST therapist. I only find one. She happens to be in Burbank. Her name was Emma. She was incredible. It's called Just Flow. And I start going to her. And at the time I'm making like $400 a week from Penny. Right. That is not a lot of money at all. Right. Yeah. I was struggling and Emma was amazing because she did a sliding scale for me. And I was so grateful. And as we're talking, I'm mentioning my acting and where I'm at, you know, mentally and emotionally and all this stuff. And she goes, you know, you should go see Dee Wallace. And I go, who? And she was like, Dee Wallace. She was the mom in ET. She does acting classes. I think you would benefit really well.
She was my neighbor in Woodland Hills.
No way.
Yeah.
So I end up emailing her and I was like, hey, I heard you have an acting studio. Like, can I join? And her assistant was like, she doesn't do that anymore. She does healing work. It's pretty much the same thing. Come on down.
Dee Wallace was doing that CMT, whatever the...
CST, yeah. CST, so yeah. I will tell you this. So I had tonight, this is about 5 years into it. I had terrible tinnitus, which is the, you know, really bad ringing in the ear all for 5 years. I went to Emma, tinnitus gone.
Wow.
I was just like, this is amazing. Like, thank you. Worth every penny. So then she mentions Dee, and I look at Dee, and her prices were like really high for me. $400 a week. And I was like, I can't, like, it was September. And I was like, I can't right now, but I'm going to keep in the, but I kept thinking about her and thinking about her Christmas. I signed up for her newsletter during Christmas. Mm-hmm. She had a holiday special where her prices were like $100 for a session. And I was like, I'm going to do it. Like, I want this. Now I will say, which I thought was interesting. I said to Emma, you know, you're like the only CST therapist. And she goes, what are you talking about? There's 7 on this block alone. And I go, wow. When I looked up CST therapy, you were the only one that showed up. And I thought that was kind of interesting. It's like, I was meant to go to her and then get segued to Dee.
Yeah.
And I did one healing session with Dee. Whatever she does, she does. She's like psychic. She's amazing. Incredible work. I took out a new credit card and paid for her for a year with this new credit card because she has an annual year. Like,
were you seeing progress in week one or month one? And you're just on blind faith. I just felt you feel like something's going to happen after a certain time.
With the session with Dee or with the CST therapy?
With Dee.
Session one with Dee, she blew me away. She was just like, she just knew things about me that, I mean, you wouldn't know the first time, you know? And
so was this more like, you know, psychic, but what about the results, the raw results of your ear or what?
So she was like, she's able, like the way she works is like, she's like, all right, tell me what's going on. And I'll be like, well, I lost my hearing. And she'd be like, stop. She'd be like, what happened when you were like 5 and this happened to you? And then, or like, you know, oh, you know, you just wanted to shut off the world and there was all these things were going on and, oh, and your mom or your dad or, you know, this impacted you and this limited belief happened to you. And she can just tell you what limited belief you took on and what, and how it impacted your life today and how you can unshift that limited belief to then create the life that you want now. Mm-hmm. So that's what we work on. We do limited belief work. And one session with her, I was like, oh my, like we did money the first time and she doesn't, you have to see her once a month. I mean, you don't have to, I'm saying like she does her sessions once a month because it takes 4 to 6 weeks to shift a belief. And if you come back the next week, well, you didn't do anything. Like you have to wait the 4 weeks to, you have to do the work. You have to put in the time.
Right.
It's not like, and you have to do the
work.
You
could have fast-tracked that kind of like neuro-linguistic programming, NLP, right? Which sounds like a little bit like that. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, I've heard of that. I've never done it, but okay. I've heard of it. And and so I would do whatever she told me to do. She said, jump. I said, how high? I'm paying her a lot of money to tell me what to do. I'm not going to question it. So I did it and I was just blown away. Like the first session we did, like, we did happiness and we like took, cause I was so sad at the time. I was just like in a bad place. And within 4 months, like it felt like my sadness or depression or whatever. I feel like there's a really bad stigma around the word depression, but like, I just feel like whatever it was that was just like holding me down, just got lifted off of me. And I was just like, if this is what one session is like, I can't even imagine what a year is going to be like. And she hooked me up with her osteopath who, well, we did a bunch of money work, me and Dee.
When you say money work, just explain to everybody what's money work.
So we did like a lot of like a limited, I had a lot of limited beliefs on money, like that I'm never going to have enough money. I'm always, you know, all that stuff, you know, and when she helped me shift that, it was just really weird. Like money just kept, I won a lawsuit that I didn't even know I was in for $750.
Right.
Like things are just happening. And I'm like, oh my God. And, and then she brings me, she said, check out this osteopath. This guy was $750 for the first visit.
Oh,
and then $350 to $550 a visit after that. It depends on the work that he did. Yeah. And let me tell you, when it comes to your health, there really shouldn't be a price on it at it. So, I mean, I feel like, you know, it really depends. But for me, I was at a point where like, there's no price I can put to get my hearing back. Like, you know, just
sure.
Throw a number down. So I said, $750, no problem. And at the time I ended up working with Penny again. So what happened is I ended up working for that TV show Wrecked. It ended. And I said, you know what? I'm going to go acting. Penny was mentioning acting. I like acting. Let me try acting. So I did what every actress is going to do. And I got a restaurant job
that's an acting job too.
And yes. And while I was working in a restaurant, I was like doing auditions and things like that. And auditions are a lot harder to get than people realize. They're not dime a dozen. And
right. And, 30 and, auditions just to get the part too.
Go exactly. On. Exactly. So Penny's new assistant that I helped hire quit one day, just like walked out and was like, I'm done. I'm never coming back. This place is a nightmare. Like, I'm done with you. Yeah. So they were so desperate that they called me and they're like, would you come back? And I said, here are my conditions. And they honored every condition that I had.
Starting to know your worth.
Yeah.
That's D. That's D's enabling beliefs, eliminating the disabling beliefs that when they called you back, if you probably didn't go to D with the reframing of those beliefs, then you might not have asked for those things.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Very true. Okay. So I ended up working for Penny. I ended up keeping the restaurant job as well, because it was like phenomenal money. So I did that and Penny. And then, so I was like, all right, I'm going to do this Dr. Hogopian in, you know, Santa Monica in LA, the osteopath.
Yeah.
I did 6 weeks with him. I'll tell you why. I mean, 6 months with him, and I'll tell you why. The first session, I said to him, listen, I don't care what anyone says. I'm telling you I have hearing. I'm telling you that I've been doing a lot of work on my hearing. I got rid of my tinnitus with obviously some help, and I've been doing some hearing exercises. And I'm like, and I've been hearing in this ear, like very little, but it's been happening where I'm able to talk on the phone, not well, but I could hear people on the phone and stuff like that. I'm telling you, I have hearing. So all of a sudden he did some test, like with those pitchforks and stuff with my ear and everything. It was hard to hear out of my good ear. So it was like really hard to hear out of my left ear with whatever he was doing.
Yeah.
So like you couldn't lie during this test is pretty much what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden we finished and he goes, I believe you. I believe that you have hearing and that you can get some of your hearing back. I really believe that. And he said, let me do some work on you. And he started doing some work. And
what kind of work?
I can't even explain it. He just like touched my skull and my back and whatever. It's like cranial.
What's an osteopath for denotatively for everybody listening?
I don't know.
Is it like a homeopathic, more like alternative medicine kind of doctor?
Yeah, and it's kind of like a chiropractor in a way, I want to say. But
are they the ones where you hold something that you like a protein powder and it's like, look, your arm, you know, and it's like is weak now, but now when you hold this, it's stronger, that kind of guy?
Kind of. I want to say, I mean, all the osteopaths that may be listening to this are going to be like, she doesn't know what she's talking about.
Well, whatever. All right. So he's like, an osteopath. He's working. He's touching your neck and your brain.
He stuffed my whole body. I don't know. And he just opened stuff up. He was opening up whatever was stuck in there or whatever was happening. But he was the first guy that said, I believe you. And that's where the hope comes in. It's the whole entire time for the last 5 to 6 years, I was told I'm never going to hear again. And right. I was the only person that believed in me. And that is daunting. That is, you know, when you're the only person in the arena and you're getting beaten up, I mean, you're really getting beaten up.
Right.
So the fact that there was this one guy who's a doctor that said to me, I believe you. I just was like crying tears of joy. This is what I've been looking for. So I stuck with him and everything. And I ended up taking a hearing test. And now I took a hearing test with Emma with the CST because the tinnitus went away. And I felt like, and that's when I really believed that I was hearing and doing all those tests and stuff. And I took the test and it was a fail.
Yeah.
did the test after I worked with Dr. Agopian, a couple of years after, because I was like, I was too nervous. I'd done a lot of hearing tests over the years, and there was a lot of disappointment. I have very high expectations, which I'm learning to get rid of all expectations. They're not good for you. Yeah.
Especially when you do stand-up comedy. Go on.
Yeah. I went to a hearing place and I took a hearing test and I said, here's my old tests. They didn't believe it. They were like, you hear, you could get a hearing aid. Like you're, cause I was never allowed to get a hearing aid. I wasn't able to get a hearing aid because there's no hearing. A hearing aid amplifies hearing. If there's no hearing to amplify, the hearing aid's not going to work.
Right.
So I was never able to get a hearing aid. So they said, I don't believe this. I don't believe that you've never had hearing. And I go, well, here's the test. And I was like, and I've had like 100 of these. And they couldn't believe it because they don't know anyone who's ever regained hearing before.
Right. And ear damage, they say you cannot get back.
You cannot get back. And yeah, they looked at it and they said, listen, like, you know, percentages don't matter. But I'm just like, there's no such thing as a percentage of hearing. But from your tests and what I'm seeing, you increased 85%.
Wow.
And my brain was like, that's not 100. Like still got work to do, but no, I was very happy. And then I was able to get a hearing aid. I ended up not getting it because I just was like, this is 85% is great.
Is that where you are today?
I haven't taken a test since then. I will say I do feel like it's gotten better and improved, but it, you know, it's still not as powerful as my right ear.
Was it a quick moment? Kind of like, you know, how like your ear drained from a swimming pool, you know, water in your ear, or was it a gradual over like weeks or months?
I think it was gradual. I want to say it was gradual because I was waiting for that moment. I was waiting for like a pop. I was waiting for like something to happen, you know, where, you know, there was a fireworks show because I got my hearing back. Then that didn't happen. There was no pop. There was no, oh, suddenly it was there. I believe it was a gradual, like, you know, where I didn't really notice it because I've always believed I had it.
Yeah. So that's unheard of because I used to promote nightclubs for many years. And I remember one night I was standing in front of a loudspeaker, you know, and my eardrum popped. It like collapsed and I still could hear, but it's like definitely lost some percentages compared to the other ear.
Oh.
And I talked to the ear doctor, you know, years later. I was like, yeah, that happened. You know, it was like a pretty, you know, he's like, I said, what do I eat? What do I do? What do I exercise? What do I, you know, he's like, there's nothing you could do. He's like, you can't get partial damage improved, you know, but you're the only person I've ever heard that had zero. And then you got 85%. That's significance. If you were to plug up the other ear, what would you hear?
I mean, I feel like I can make things, I can make out, you know, I could hear things. I'd be able to, and I started learning, like I was getting better. I also noticed like at location, cause like when you have only one ear, you can't, you know, you don't get the locate, you know, Marco Polo, you're losing every time. You're not.
Right. Yeah. But also there's like a mechanical thing, just not the hearing, where it's your equilibrium, so to speak, you know, is affected by that. So now that counteracts that negative aspect.
Yeah. And yeah. So, you know, to be able to get what I got back was an amazing, I mean, I literally wanted to send that test to every single doctor that told me I never get back. I was so excited.
So that's your 10, that this is like this, that moment.
That was my 10, that winner. Okay. Yeah.
That's a fascinating story, but spent so much more time on the ear than I wanted to, but you know what? It was so interesting and you're a really good storyteller. You're a good rock and tour. So let's get into, you know, around that time, what's going on with your career at that time?
So at that time, Penny died and I was working in a restaurant and then the restaurant went under. And then I was working at this other, I was working at two restaurants while I was working with Penny because I knew she was going soon. And I wasn't sure what was next for me. During that I worked for Penny for 5 years. During those 5 years, it was amazing because she allowed me to use all of her contacts, which is very rare, rare that a celebrity is going to do that. And she signed anything I wanted. So if I wanted a recommendation to be a director's assistant to get, you know, on the Warner Brothers lot, she signed it. She was really wonderful in that aspect. So I was able to be like a director's assistant for Phil Lewis, who was the actor in, I think it was Suite Life and Zack and Cody. But he's now like this, he's like this huge sitcom director now. And I got to be on Dr. Ken and shadow him. He was amazing. And I got a bunch of acting roles due to me being Penny Marshall's assistant. Mm-hmm. So it worked out really well. And she was really great like that. So when she left, I was like, oh my God, what am I going to do now? Like, she was my bread and butter. And then I was working at like two restaurants, and then the restaurant was going under, and this other restaurant I was working at was just the worst toxic environment ever.
What year is this?
And this had to be like 2000. And she died, I believe, in like 2017 or 18 or something like that. I think around there. Okay. And then I, so then I did that, and then COVID happened like around all around this time. Yeah.
What happened in those 3 years? What's going on in your career? Penny dies, then the restaurant closes. That's during, then what's going on in that 3 years?
So what happened was, Penny dies, and I think, I really don't remember if it was 2018, 2000. I think it was the end of 2018. I'm not sure.
Okay.
But I was like, I started doing stand up. So at one of the restaurants I worked at, Nick Swartzen was a regular. And Nick Swartzen. Yeah.
He was when you said you were working at the restaurant, he was what at the restaurant?
He was a regular. He like showed up all the time.
Oh, regular at the restaurant.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah. And I remember going to the Comedy Store to see a friend perform comedy.
Yeah.
And I went with two other friends. And I looked at the stage and I thought, looks so fun. Like, I could do this. And I remember driving home and I looked at my friend and I said, I'm going to do that. I'm going to do stand-up comedy. And he just started laughing because he doesn't find me funny. Not me feel too. So I was like, okay, right? And I looked at him so serious because I was so offended that you just laughed in my face. That I said, give me 1 month. And I'll be up on that comedy stage, actually, one month. And in 1 month, I ended up on that exact stage.
Where's your fear level at this point? Because when you were working with the acting teacher, getting on stage and being vulnerable, and then you get about 30, 40 students looking at you and you're talking about personal stuff. But when you get on stage at the Comedy Store, which I've been there many times, I performed at the Belly Room. That was like a sweet spot for me.
Yes, there's a room. Yeah. Belly Room. Yeah.
Something happens when you go 6 inches higher than everybody else and you're in a room of 100 people and you have nothing but you and a microphone, and they have to laugh at you with a certain amount of LPMs last per minute. Otherwise, you're going to feel really shitty. And that's a lot. That is more scary for some people than death. How did you reconcile that? Went your first time.
So what no one told me that really made it really easy was that I can't see them. I am on that stage.
I'm the opposite. I need to see those eyeballs to kind of communicate. And like, that helps me.
No.
So you don't want to see the faces.
I don't want to see you. I want to pretend that it's just like me on the stage and nobody else there. When I first stepped on the stage, so I ended up doing an open mic. So what happened is I was like, I'm going to do stand-up comedy. I'm going to do this. And I gave myself a month time. And during that time, like it was like 3 weeks into it, I got nothing. I don't know how to write comedy. I don't know what I'm doing.
How often were you going up? Once a week?
No, I wasn't even going up at all. So within this month, I was just like, because I said, I'm give myself a month.
Oh, okay. This preparing.
I didn't know anything. I was so naive. And I will tell you, my whole entire life, I just jumped. I didn't research it. I didn't know much when it came to business, when it comes to my book, when it comes to life, I know nothing. And I just kind of tell myself I'm going to do something and just assume that it just happens, which, I don't know if it's great or not, but I didn't know about open mics really or anything. And so I was just like in my room or at I actually was still, it was my last year, I think, when I was working for Penny. And I was just like writing, trying to write a joke or whatever. I didn't even know there's a formula for writing comedy. I knew nothing. Right. A friend of mine invited me to her movie premiere, and was like, we're going to get some dinner with some friends. Do you want to come? And I said, yes. I say yes to everything. You invite me, I'm showing up.
Right.
And the girl that happens to be also, that also showed up for our friend, our mutual friend, was a stand-up comic. Yeah. And I said, and I was working for Penny, and she had front row seats at the Clippers and Lakers games. And she wasn't going because she was sick. And I said, I'm in charge of selling these tickets. We sell them for like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars, front row seats. And
oh, the Clippers Lakers game?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, you're talking a couple $1,000 for four seats.
Yeah.
And, one game.
Yeah. And I was selling them. So I said to her, I said, listen, you teach me stand up, I'll give you these tickets, two of them for $100.
Wow.
She was a big Laker fan. And she was like, you got it. And I gave her the tickets, and she came to Penny's and went into the office with me and taught me the formula for writing stand up. And then I took her formula and I wrote a set, and I shared it real quick.
Cause every comedian is different. Greg Dean, who's like a foremost, you know, comedy writing coach in planet Earth, he's got his method. Judy Carter's got hers. I'm just curious. Do you remember the formula that she kind of gave you?
Course.
Let's just real quick, just kind of spit it out a little bit.
Yeah. So she said, I want you to write things about you, like on a piece of paper, like that are different, you know, like you wear glasses, you're short, you know, all that stuff.
An association list.
Yeah. So write it all down. And then she goes, and I want you to write a box. I want you to take one genre, whatever you chose. It's like, I chose being short as my first thing I ever wrote about. She goes, put short in the middle of the piece of paper with a bubble around it. And then make a box, a cross around that bubble. So you'll get four boxes. And she goes, I want you to write weird, hard, scary, and stupid in each box.
All negative denominators. Yeah.
And then I want you to write what's weird, what's hard, what's scary, and what's stupid about being short.
Yeah.
And then I want you to pick one and then write a story about it. So my first one was, one of the hard things about being short is constantly being mistaken for a child.
Yeah.
And then I go into the story and stuff like that. And she goes, stick to this formula. It's going to help you with writing. And then eventually, you know, you won't keep saying weird, stupid, hard, or scary. You know, it'll just kind of be a story of comedy.
Right.
So I did that. And then I went to doing my first open mic. And my whole restaurant like showed up for me, which was amazing. Yeah. And I was the crazy part was, and thank God that they showed up, because I didn't know this about an open mic. No one laughs. The comics don't care about you.
No, if the open mic's usually filled with comedians, and the comedians, this is how a comedian laughs. They shake their head up and down and go, funny, funny. That's it. That's a comedian laugh. Yeah.
So I don't know how I would have handled that for my first time being up on stage. And that's why I tell people that want to break into comedy, like bring friends to your first open mic or book a show and bring people, because people that go see a show want to laugh.
Yes.
Except for those difficult ones that, you know, whatever. But, you know, so you're going to get support. And I really believe that when you're first starting out in anything, the more support you get, the more hope you're going to get. I mean, it goes down to hope, you know, on believing in yourself and everything. So my restaurant came, I was the last person to go up. So all the comics, another thing that they don't tell you is that open mics, when the comic finishes, they leave. They're not staying for you. They did their set. They tried it out. They're going home.
Right.
So I was the only person there. So the host, me, and then my restaurant who waited for me. And I get up on the stage and everyone's cheering because they're for me. And I do my bit and I thought it was great. I thought I crushed it, but of course I crushed it. It's my friends in the audience. They're laughing. But the guy that was hosting is also a producer. And he was like, that was really funny. How long have you been doing comedy? I've never seen you around. And I go, my first night. So he booked me for a show. And then the next day, Nick Swartzen was sitting in the restaurant And I went out, I was like, Nick, and we were talking prior to this. So he was very supportive and giving me advice for stand-up. Nice. And he goes, Gina, how did you do last night? And I go, amazing. Here's the fit. I went so well. And he goes, I'm doing a show Friday. Come open for me.
What the fuck? Like, that doesn't. What? Okay. Look, that just doesn't happen. I mean, the fact that was your second show was opening up for Nick Swarzan.
My second real show. So the open mic.
That is sick. That is awesome. That is fun.
Crazy. And he was like, come
scared
over.
Scared shit. You should have been.
I was like, oh. I said to him, I was like, do you want to see my tape? And he goes, no, it's fine. And nice. He goes, how much?
Sounds like a nice guy.
So nice. And he goes, how much? I goes, I'll give you 8 minutes. Is that good?
Whoa, nice.
And I go, I only have 4 prepared. And yeah. He was like, whatever you got, just get up there and have some fun. Yeah. And it was a sold out crowd, like 300 people. And looking back on it now, it was terrible in terms of my material and what I wrote, but I had the time of my life. Like people laughed and it was fun because 300 people, someone's going to laugh, you know, like,
yes.
You know, it's very different when you do a show for 10 versus a show for 300.
Absolutely.
So I ended up doing that show for Nick. And actually, there was a guy in the audience there that I ended up hiring a year later when I was working for Penny as our script reader. And I remember like interviewing him and he goes, wait a minute, Gina Cazaza. And I go, yeah, he goes, did you open for Nick Swarton that time? And I was like, oh my God. But so then I ended up opening for Nick at the Improv. And then a friend of mine was doing a show with someone at the Comedy Store. And that's how I ended up on that exact stage that I said I would be on a month later. And I did. And then I just started doing comedy. Unfortunately, I don't do it as, I don't treat it like a job because it's not a job for me. It's,
right.
It's fun. That's
a tough one to make a job.
It's tough. And you know, and you gotta write every day and you gotta like, you know, work at it. And I love it, but I don't want to put the time into it because for me, it's just fun. It's not a job. If something happens with it, great. If not, you know,
The best way to do comedy, in my opinion, is that you need to do it right every day, go up every night. You need to go on the road every night so you get fresh audiences and different types of audiences. I mean, that's really the way that river should flow. And, you know, if you can't, and you like in my case, I just decided I'm going to do stand up again, you know, about 6 rooms from now. And I just decided I'm probably going to do it to the day I die. And I'm probably going to just try to get once a weekend. But it's not going to be as good as it can be. And if you're serious about being a comedian, I mean, you're going to agree with this. You should write every day and you should go up every night. That's it.
Yeah, I agree. If you're going to do it, you got to do it, you know, right. And for me, I'm not that committed to it. And it's sad. It's not sad. It's great for me. Like, you know, I look at myself and I really love being up on that stage. I feel like I have this natural stage presence that I feel like could go somewhere, but at the same time, I made that choice for me to just make it fun, you know. And now,
let me tell you, you're a really good rock and tour. So the bass is there, right? Then it's timing, and then the pitches. When you're up on stage, the pitches need to slow down because when you're on stage, you know, you get to get that momentum and the twitch speed response of how you're delivering your material. So then when you do look at faces beyond the lights, you now have the relationship with the audience. And that comes with going up every night, you know, writing and then getting used to new material and then trying it out on the fly. And then that bandaloop of the audience and then that timing, you know, those moments, somebody drops a glass, you have 5 responses, but in the circumstance you're going to use response number 2, all those pitches slow down, you know, you're hitting them, but that only happens with time. So you have the base, and that's the hardest part, really. If you somebody that understands psychology, somebody that understands people, somebody that understands, you know, what people are going to, your audience and the relationship, obviously you're great with relationships. That's to me, most importantly, just talking to you today. I was supposed to talk to you for 35 minutes. I'm like, I can't stop talking to this gal with this fucking ear story. It's like, it's great. You know,
this is a long one.
Yeah, keep on going though. So yeah. I want to know. So where are you at today with your stand-up comedy, and then segue into, you wrote a children's book, you know, I want to know why and all that, but talk about where you're at with stand-up.
So I've just had fun with stand-up. It's been making me a great writer. I write for TV. I do pilots, and I'm pitching right now and putting shows together and stuff. So stand-up has really helped me with being funnier and punchier. And even if I'm writing a drama, it just helps me to, you know, stand-up is all about getting to the point and getting in and getting out. And it's helped
me. Cut that fat off.
Yes. So it's helped me become a much better writer. And that's what happened during COVID. So when COVID hit, I know that people had a terrible year. It was one of my best years. It changed my life in the best way, because I was working at a restaurant, and in the creative business, I didn't know what audition was going to be the one or whatever. And so COVID hit and my restaurant shut down that I was working at. And I remember calling my friend and being like, my restaurant just shut down for 2 weeks. I'm going to go see my parents in New York. I'll come back in a week. We'll go to a national park. And then I go back to work because, you know, it stopped the spread 2 weeks. So that day my restaurant shuts down. I book a flight to New York and I fly home to New York. And my mom was like, don't buy a ticket back. You know, this could be longer than 2 weeks. You might want to stay longer. And I ended up staying for like 6 months.
Sure.
And during that time I was writing, and I created two pilots, and I was doing some stand-up writing, and I was building a business. I actually launched a crystal business in March of 2020, not on purpose. Like, I was planning this launch for 6 months. I had a launch party, everything, and everything shut down, and my launch party never happened. And I launched this crystal business online, and I didn't go to business school. I have this, again, this naive attitude where I put something out there, the world's going to buy it. And, you know, and I'm living pretty. It doesn't work like that. And I didn't understand that.
You showed me this bracelet that you did. You know, it looks pretty cool too. It's got
this is new.
Yeah. So this bracelet is like, it's got like, you know, the Haiti, you know, Fiji kind of beads on it, you know, ones, but it's also got this electric, it looks like a crystal. A flat piece of black.
It's black onyx. It's real onyx. Black.
Yeah. And, but that you put, now you connected that to an app. Will you push that up to a phone? What does it do?
It, a web link pops up. So it's a web app, not a phone app. So a web link pops up when you tap this to your phone or scan it around your phone, and it takes you to an app that, so this is a love bracelet. We got love, calm, inspired, and joy. So all themes and feeling themes. So when you tap this to the bracelet, you actually get access, no matter which bracelet you have, to all four of the themes. Uh-huh. And you can click any one. So if you are feeling down and you want joy, just click the joy bracelet, and it gives you motivational tips around joy, joy exercises, breathing exercises, all around joy, meditation music, and it gives you a journal prompt and your own digital journal. So all around these themes. So like, I use it all the time in the creative. I use inspired like left and right. I'm like working and I like click inspired to put on music and do breathing and energy. So what happened was, is I launched this crystal business, bracelet business.
Yeah.
And then I started learning like about business and how to get it out there and what to do and all that stuff. And then I went back to LA and my mom came with me, and my brothers live in LA as well. And LA was still shut down. I mean, LA was shut down for
LA just like stopped being shut down like 3 weeks ago, and it's 2023.
It was like, it was weird. But the crazy part too was Long Island didn't, like Long Island by the summer was opened, and which was very different than the city. Like the city was again like another LA, but Long Island was operating and open. So I was, you know, able to figure like do some stuff and try some stuff out. So I went back to LA, and I'm still like big now. I'm like, all right, I created a TV pilot. I don't have Penny anymore. Now what do I do? So then I'm trying to figure out those contacts. And, but then the industry is still not working. They're not doing much. So I remember sitting in my apartment with my mom, and COVID crazy was going on. Put it this way, it was so crazy that one of my neighbors in my apartment complex called the building manager on me because I was walking my dog across the street without a mask on. Oh, a year later, I was like, it's fresh air. I'm not like, are you kidding? I said, this is getting crazy. I can't even walk outside my home without these people like calling whoever the city on me.
Where was this in LA?
Studio City.
Of course it was. Yeah. I'm from Encino and I lived in Sherman Oaks for like 10 years.
That's where I lived for 7 years.
Yeah. And I love home. I now live north of Austin, Texas, in Georgetown, Texas for 13 years. And I love home. But shit's gone crazy. You know, it's like, what the hell? People are like, you know, like this overzealous Karen-esque kind of like, you know, crap and policing people. And it's like, what the hell?
It was ridiculous. I'm outside. Okay. Yeah. Like ridiculous. I was just like, okay. So me and my mom were sitting in, and we came from Long Island. It was like free, you know, I'm like, oh my God. So my mom was like, you know what we need to do? We need to strengthen our mindset. Like, this is too much. Like, and this, it does have a negative impact on you when you can't even go outside without, and the crime was so high. People were punching people because, you know, with stuff. And my mom was like, oh my gosh, like, you know, we need to strengthen our mindset. And
this is still in a borough from New York, and they're going to LA going, this place is fucking crazy.
Crazy. And I remember her saying that, and I go, you know what? Say no more. I'm on it. I'm going to get us someone to help strengthen our mindset. Now, she thought that because I'm really into meditation and spiritual healing and all that stuff, that I was going to find like some guru that does like a meditation retreat to, you know, do whatever. I just finished reading the book, Living with a Seal by Jesse Itzler. Have you heard of it?
No, but I know your story and I know where this is going to go. Now you're going to train with this Navy SEAL guy, right?
Yeah. Well, not him in particular, but I read the book, Living with a Seal. And I was like, fascinated. I was like, oh my God, this is no joke. Like, talk about strengthening your mind and your body. Like, I need a Navy SEAL. I need a partner. That's a Navy SEAL. So I started Googling Navy SEALs that I can, you know, find and train with that would help strength. I was looking for like a personal Navy SEAL trainer for me and my mom to be tough and strengthen ourselves. And I end up coming across a guy named Coach Mac, and he's a former Navy SEAL, and he runs this program called Team Eagle One. And at the time it was in Santa Monica, California. And now I believe it's in Northern California. And I was like, and it was a free program, completely free. And what he does is he takes people in the service or that want to be in special forces, and he trains them. And he has a 96% success rate to be a Navy SEAL, which is unheard of, because it's like a 7% success rate if you you just go in to do it. So this guy is 96%. He's no joke. And I was like, no, I want a private guy. And I couldn't find one. And I ended up one day, just when my mom was like, we got to strengthen our mindset and, you know, crime on the rise and all that stuff, I just looked at myself and I was like, I wonder if I could survive a kidnapping.
Yeah. And here we go with this. This is fun. Okay. Yeah. Go on.
So I said to myself, like, I wonder if I could survive a kidnapping. And then I was like, I think people pay. Like, I think there gotta be like a program. Like, what if someone comes behind me when I'm putting groceries in my car and tries to stuff me in their like backpack or something? Like, I'm a goner. Like, I'm a tiny person. Right. So I started Googling like kidnapping experience, like kidnapping schools and kidnapping experiences and surviving a kidnapping. And I end up coming across this survival school, Tom Coin Survival School in LA, and they put on a civilian Sir, do you know about Sir? It's Sir or Sir? Sir.
Yeah. What's
so, Sir is survival, invasion, resistance, escape. All the special force military guys do it. It's like a 21-day program for this survival school. It's only a weekend, but it's pretty much like if you were to get kidnapped by a terrorist, how will you survive and what will you do? And when the special forces go through it, it's like, it's no joke. You know, you don't eat, you only get what you're wearing and you're in the wilderness and you have to survive. And it's crazy. I didn't know, again, any of this. I thought I was just signing up for a normal kidnapping. You know, I didn't know it was like the Taliban.
You know, like, you know, that old chestnut, like most of us do. We're just looking for a normal kidnapping. I wasn't expecting all the trimmings. Okay.
So I called the school and he told me about it and I sign up. I was like, all right, I'll give this a shot. So then I was like, I'm not gonna start. It was like 2 months. It was like in February I sign up and the kidnapping was in May. And I'm like, I need to train for this. Like, I know nothing. I don't go to the gym. I don't do any exercise. Like, I'm a goner. So then I was like, I got to contact this Navy SEAL. So I email him and I said, listen, like, I know your programs for military and special forces, but I just trained to get kidnapped and I could really use some help. Can I just see if I could survive one day of training with you to give me some hope that I can make it out alive in this kidnapping? And he was like, come, if you're crazy enough to get kidnapped, like I gotta meet you, like, come on down.
Yeah.
So I was like, all right, cool. I'll Dude, let
this
you
better
know
be when. In your stand up.
Yeah, it's is not it? Yet. I gotta,
okay, you know,
yet.
Here's the thing: the hearing thing and this really, you know, that's that you need to just, you know, find the punches because this is a good premise.
Yeah,
go on.
That's my problem right now. I gotta find my punches.
Oh, they're there. You'll find them.
Yeah, I'll get there. I've been working on it for 2 years. It'll come. So
you're the wonderful strength you have is your ability to put yourself in these weird fucking situations.
Yeah,
the punchlines will come from those. Go on.
So I said, I'll let you know when. And he was like, I'll see you on Sunday. And I was like, oh, okay. And now I'm committed. And another thing from my childhood that my parents taught me was if you commit to something, you don't back out. Like, you made a commitment, you follow through on that commitment.
There's that old thing, yeah.
And, you know, it's been ingrained in me. So when I committed to this guy, I was like, I'm in, like, what am I doing? These guys are in fatigue. They have a uniform. So I just show up. He's like, show up to whatever you have. This is the uniform, but you know, you show up in whatever you have. So their uniform is fatigues, white t-shirt, combat boots. And I had women's combat boots, you know, they're made for fashion, not war.
Yeah.
So I wore them with like yoga pants and a white t-shirt because all I had, and I go to the beach and there are these like 8 dudes that are gigantic. They're muscular. They look like real G.I. Joe action figures in the flesh. Yeah. And there's the coach in his uniform with this giant Rottweiler. And I'm just like, I can't do this. No, like, I'm done. I turn around. I start walking to my car. And I called my uncle, who's an ex-Marine. And I was telling him, and I'm like, dude, I'm like, they look, I don't know, I can't. And he was like, I'm like, but I feel like I gotta bulk up. I gotta bulk up. I gotta do it.
Yeah.
And we ended up talking and I get off the phone with him and I go, I'm going to go. And I hang up the phone and I just start moving. My body just moves. And my mind was telling me to stop, but my body wouldn't. And I show up and I introduce myself and he's like, welcome. And then all of a sudden, like 5 minutes later, training starts. And I didn't know, he was just like, line up, and everyone lines up in one single file order, at attention or at ease, and And I'm just standing there with them going like, what did I get myself into? And then he all of a sudden goes, all right, push-ups down. And then everyone jumps down. And I just, Simon Says right now, I do what they do.
Right.
And again, I don't work out. I mean, I played sports my whole entire life, but I mean, I literally eat really, really clean and well to avoid working out, to keep the figure without right. doing any effort. Okay. So I'm 1 minute into it and I want to quit seven times. I'm just like, when is he going to say stop with this? And the training is like 2.5 to 3 hours, could be longer. He doesn't like to tell you when it's going to end. He just wants to get it going. So you don't know anything. It's like serious psychological torture there. So I'm just doing what they're doing. And then he's like, all right, warm up run. It's a race. And it was like to Tower 17 and back, which was like a mile run, by the way, on the sand, dry right. sand in this heat. And I'm saying to myself, this is a warm up. It's a race. It's a mile. I go, this guy needs to redefine what a warm-up is. Like, that's like a dog. And I was just like, last. I mean, like, these guys could order a pizza by the time I got back from the run. And then we had to do more sit-ups and push-ups and pull-ups. And then we get to the pull-ups and I jump up on the bar. They had to lift me up because I couldn't get up on the bar.
Yeah,
I'm so tiny. And then I go to do the pull-up and my body felt like it was moving, but it wasn't. Like, I was like, I couldn't move.
Yeah.
And they're like, lift yourself up. And I'm like, my face looks like it's trying, but nothing's working. And I'm like, and then they go, oh, she's going to need some help. So then they like, were doing the pull-ups
right.
and helped me. That's how bad I was. And I just like, it was the hardest thing I've ever done mentally, physically, and emotionally. I'm scared of the water, but I love the water. I'm very scared of it. So one of the things that we had to do was lay down in the swell and lock arms, and the waves would crash up onto us and we'd be doing sit-ups. And he said to me like later, he's like, when I said to get into the water, he's like, I saw the light go out on your eyes. Cause I, I was so terrified.
So let's fast track this part. Do you do the whole training?
So I finished training, couldn't walk for 4 days. I'm not even kidding. I ended up like an old lady, like hunched over, like couldn't right. walk. Like we thought we had
out.
To go to the hospital. Like I don't. So I parts of my body, like my forearm was in so much pain. I didn't even know that that could be in pain. There were just parts of me that I couldn't walk. We almost took me to the hospital because I was literally walking like an older person. I couldn't move.
So yeah. you're in traction, but so to speak. So now you go from this to, are you, how long do you prepare for the kidnapping?
Well, what happened was, is I was so blown away by this training and yeah. I was so impressed that I even accomplished it. And I was so blown away by what he does and this organization. It's absolutely incredible. I felt like a totally different human being. Like the person that went into that program for that one day of training
right.
was a totally different person coming out of it. I can't even explain to you like
sure.
how much it's changed my life. That I talked to him on the phone, Coach Mack, and I said, can I join your program? Can I officially be a part of the team? And he said, yeah. He was actually shocked that I even lasted the whole entire time. People don't, they quit in the middle of it. It's like, it's that crazy. It's that intense. So,
you're like Forrest Gump. You just show up and just keep going regardless of whatever the circumstances are. You're like, you know, Woody Allen said, you know, success is just showing up.
I showed up. So he was like, yeah, come on, keep coming, showing up.
Yeah.
So I would show up every week and I did it for a month. And then, and during that month, I didn't know this, but everything that he was training us for, like everything that I was learning in this month of training was what was going to prepare me for surviving this kidnapping.
Right.
And I didn't know that until I finished the kidnapping. So I did a month of training and then I left to do kidnapping. And it's like, it's in the middle of, it's kind of like by Big Bear, you know, Big Bear in California.
The kidnapping is near Big Bear?
Yeah. It's like in like
is that where the kidnapping camp is up there?
Yeah.
That's, come that's on, everybody. We're gonna, oh, let's go, everybody. We're going to do a kidnappings now. Yay. So, all right. So nice up in Big Bear. You would think it'd be like in Venice.
No.
Or like Watts or something.
No, it had to be in the woods because.
Oh, like in a cabin.
Well, what happens is the first day they teach you about what would happen if you were to get kidnapped. And again, like I didn't know that it was a terrorist kidnapping. So everything was about like overseas and being kidnapped and how to avoid being kidnapped and what to do at hotels and all this stuff when you're in a foreign country and the embassy and all that stuff. So again, I didn't know what I was getting into until I was sitting there going, this is not the kidnapping I thought I signed up for.
This is like, you're like Judy Benjamin from a Private Benjamin. You're like, I think this is the wrong army. I was going to go to the army with the condos and everything. You were like that. You're like, you went through the SEAL training, but you're like, you got okay, got it. Go on.
Well, and two, like they send you a list, an itinerary of like what you need, like what to bring for this weekend. And they were like a tent and all stuff. And I go, well, I need this stuff or I'm getting kidnapped. Like, why do I need a tent? So I almost didn't buy any of this stuff. And then I suddenly was like, you know, just buy it just in case, have it in your car. Thank God I did, because the first night is normal. Like you sleep in a tent, it's all training and teaching you. They taught you like how to get out of handcuffs and how to get out of zip ties and duct tape and all that, and how to get out of trunks and all this other stuff. So it was all about teaching and learning. And then they're going to put you to the test. So I remember them wanting us, like putting us in different stress positions and, you know, as a team, they broke us up into teams and put us in stress positions and stuff. And they went around asking like, what number are you at? What number, like in stress, like 1 to 10, what's your pain level?
Real quick. This is everybody listening. And this is for you because this particular subject is so big. I'm going to have you just bullet point this. And then the Bolator podcast is starting in 6 months from now. We're going to have you come on and we're going to have you come on and just talk about this particular situation.
Okay.
Because Bolator is a new brand and company that I'm opening up, and it's going to have its own podcast. Like Yeti has its own podcast, and we talk about nothing but outdoor survival, prepping, outdoor sports, you know, and adventures, and that particular story as opposed to the person. So I want to finish up with you, you know, bullet point this, and then I want to get to the, I could talk to this chick all freaking day. This is fascinating stuff. You don't mind I call you chick. We have that rapport already. So like, I seriously, luckily there's no other podcast interviews today. This is hilarious, but I want you to like, you know, just kind of taper this up and then I want to find out more about the book and, what you're doing right now.
Yeah.
But like give me a Reader's Digest version of the
book. Pretty much like you know, they did a bunch of stuff to us, you know, stress positions, all this stuff, and everything that I was playing the game because my coach was teaching me about, he went through SEER or SIR, whatever it's called. Like he went through it. So he was giving me advice for how I'm going to get through it. And he's like, you're a weak link. Like you're the one that they're going to be worried about because you look like, you know, you wouldn't make it. So he goes, play that card the whole entire time. So pretty much that's what I was doing the whole entire time. And what happened was, is they throw a flash pin into the room. So at any point in the game, you could get kidnapped. So at one point they threw a flash pin into the room and they yelled, everybody get down. And I jumped down and there was about 12 of us that were participating in this program. And they had like 20 people surrounding the building that they threw the flash pin in, and they ran in to grab you, and they would put a bag over your head and zip tie you and all this stuff. And again, there are so many people. So you couldn't, I remember my coach in my head going, situational awareness, look up, always know what's going on. So I look up and I saw like a bunch of people that were in the program with me that were running out to escape. And I was like, oh my God. You cannot get kidnapped. You could escape. I didn't think escape was an option. That should be your first option. You know, like don't get kidnapped in the first place should be number one option. Right. So I saw them running and I ended up getting out. Now, I'll tell you more of the story on the other podcast. So I ended up escaping, and they hunt you all night. So they have paintballs, which are supposed to simulate like if it was a real gun. So if you get shot, you go down. They have like an infrared goggle so they could like see through like your bushes and stuff to find you. They have a drone, and they also have cars. We're on foot, and we have to, and this is why it's in the mountains, because you're like suddenly in Hunger Games and you're running through the woods and you're escaping from being captured, and you have to find shelter and or build shelter, and you end up surviving all night for 12 hours in the woods.
Right.
And I did. And it was like 36 degrees outside. I'm cuddling with four strangers, COVID is going on, and we're just like, wow, if the CDC could see us now, like,
like, all right. So you do this program.
So I do the program.
You get your little certificate, you know, you get your rape certificate afterwards.
Get it.
Or you're right. Not a rape. What am I? Well, rape and kidnapping. I don't, you know, rape, kidnapping always is followed by, it's like peanut butter and jelly. A kidnapping always accompanies a nice rape.
And
you know,
murder. Yeah.
That's another class though. You got to pay extra for that. All right. So now
you finish.
You finish. We're going to get, if you guys want to hear a nice, interesting story, Bolator podcast, 6 months from now, stay tuned. We're going to have Gina Cazaza back on for that. How do you, when COVID's done,
So I finish the kidnapping, and I go back to Navy SEAL training. I'm now there for another month because I decided I'm going to leave my apartment in LA and I'm going to go back to Long Island and live right now. LA again was still shut down. I was like, I'm done. So during this month, I'm still working with Dee. I've been with Dee for 5 years now, been seeing her every single month religiously for 5 years, working on stuff.
Dee, your mom from ET, the actress from ET, she's now a holistic, CST.
An energy. She's like an energy healer. Yeah. And I said to her, I was like, I am always last in this Navy SEAL training. I'm the runt of the litter. I've been at it for 2 months. Like, what the heck? Like, I'm terrible. It's embarrassing. And she was like, you don't feel like you belong. And I was like, oh my God, she's right. Like, she's like, you know, you a whole entire life, you felt like an outsider and, you know, you just always didn't feel like you were with the pack and fit in. And I was like, oh my God. Yes. That speaks my language. And so she was like, let's work on you belonging in the world. You need to start learning that you belong and you belong here and learning what the meaning of belonging is. Right. So we were working on that. And I show up to training and I'm working on it. And she was like, I want you to visualize yourself first in front of the pack. And she's like, and every single time I want you to say to yourself, I belong here, you know, and just get into that. And one day in the middle of training, it just happened. It just clicked. I was just like, oh, I belong. Like, I feel it. I know it. I understand it. I get it. And then I was like, so blown away by what the meaning of belonging truly means. And it didn't mean that I needed to fit in because I couldn't change myself to be like these guys. I was never going to. And the two girls that were in the program that were like G.I. Janes, I was like never going to be them. So, but what I was able to do was show up as my authentic self and was accepted, and I accepted me, and I accepted me for who I was, and they accepted me. And that's true belonging. True belonging is showing up as your authentic self and not changing for other people. So I was so blown away, and I was like, wow, if little Gina could have learned that at five, my life would have been very different. And so
owning your place in the world is such a huge thing. And once you grasp that, magical things start to have a paradigm shift. You'll make a shift and you'll be able to attain more of the things you want in life. I truly believe that.
When I understood and learned that I belonged, when I went to Long Island, I started breaking out into the comedy scene. Mm-hmm. It just happened. Like, I just meshed with everyone. I was booking shows after shows. And then someone was like, it's so crazy. It's like you've always belonged here. And it was just like this validation of what I've been working on for the last couple of months. Yeah. And so when I was before Long Island, I was finishing up Navy SEAL training. And I said, it was my last day of training before I went back to Long Island. And I said, thanks guys for everything. It changed my life. And I'm actually going to write a book about belonging. I'm going to write a children's book about belonging in the world and what it truly means to belong. So
very nice. Now you wrote real quick, show your book and this book that you wrote now is you're really true.
You really truly do belong. Yeah.
When did you write that book?
So the last day of Navy SEAL training, I left, it was a Sunday. Monday, I took myself to Joshua Tree and I wrote it that night, 4 hours.
Wow.
And
like Reservoir Dogs, that shit, you know, like up at the Joshua Tree, which is a great place to write.
Yeah. And I called my friend, and I said to my friend Ivy, I'm going to read you this book I just wrote. Tell me what you think. And I read it. She was, oh my God, I love it. I said, excellent. I'm going to turn it into a children's book. And then because I committed, I made that commitment to myself. I told her I had to follow through. And a year and a half later came this book. And it was such a journey because there comes my naivety in terms of, I wrote a book, I'm going to send it out, someone's going to take it, it's going to be published, it's going to be a New York Times bestseller, and there it goes. And that's not how it works. And I don't understand marketing still. I'm just learning. I really think like it's just throwing spaghetti on the wall and seeing what sticks. And anyone that's a marketer is like, she's clueless. I am. I understand that. So I ended up like taking 6 months to reach out to publishers and agents and stuff. No one was interested. And then I said, you know what? I'm going to self-publish. I'm just going to do it. I hired an illustrator and I asked her to draw me the main character. And then she drew this little guy and I was like obsessed with what she drew. And I hired her right there. And then like a publishing company reached out and was like, we're interested. And I was like, I'm not anymore. Like, and then I ended up writing the, she ended up doing the illustrations. It was supposed to take 4 months at the most. It took 7 months.
Yeah.
Life happened. You know, that we couldn't foresee. She got sick, kid got sick, had to move, all these things happened. And then my brother said to me one day, there's millions of children books out there. Like what makes yours different than anyone else? Like, you know, you got to think about marketing and whatever. He's like, you should turn it into a digital movie. And I was like, what? And he was like, yeah, kids are always on their phone these days and they're looking at YouTube and they're looking at stuff. Turn your book into a digital movie. And then you could sell it at a higher price because now you got a book and a movie combo. And, you know, who wouldn't want that?
Right.
So I was supposed to release the book that summer of July of 2022. And then because I wanted to turn it into a digital movie, I hired an animator. And then he took the book and the pages of the book to bring it to life. Hired a sound guy, a music composer who worked with me on all my movies that I've ever done. He's brilliant. And he did the music and the sound effects and all that stuff. And then that took 4 months to make the digital animated book. And then we finished and I put it out there. And I just wish I would have taken my time a bit more to market it and understand, like, you have to do book reviews and you got to do this and all this other stuff. I just put it out there. And, you know, the first 2 months it did great. I generated like 2K in sales, which was amazing for me. But then it just like stopped. And the thing is because, well, family and friends aren't buying, you know, like, it's like, now it's like, we have to get it out there. So then I started doing school visits and stuff. And now I'm getting into the parents groups and I'm talking about it. But it's also because it's a belonging book. Like, first of all, like everyone that emailed me and called me and texted me about the book was like, oh my God, this book was amazing. I'm really blown away. And I was like, why is this so shocking? I think everyone was like shocked.
It's shocking
like,
because you haven't done that before. You've been a stand-up comedian. You've done other things. So you got the book now. We're going to tailor this off now because, you know, we got to end sometime.
Yeah.
So you got the book. What else is going on in your career right now? Give yourself some shout outs on what's happening with you right now.
So right now I'm focusing on the book. I'm marketing that and getting that out there. I'm doing school author visits and I'm also doing DEI events. So now I became a speaker. Now I'm doing speaking events. So now I transitioned from stand-up comedy to now keynote speaking and speaking at at events for DEI and belonging, because that's what the book is about.
DEI,
and
what's that stand for?
Diversity, equality, and inclusion.
Interesting.
And,
okay.
And the thing is that, like, I have an interesting story because I trained with the Navy SEAL and learned the true meaning of belonging through a Navy SEAL program, and a kidnapping experience. Like,
yeah.
And then I share that story of belonging and what it means to belong, and people really learn. They're intrigued by it and they understand right. it, and they believe they learn belonging through the book and through my story. So I'm now on this mission to help foster belonging in school and home and work and all that. And then 2 weeks ago, I took that crystal bracelet business that was just crystal bracelets,
yeah.
and I turned it into a tech bracelet business, because we're always evolving. We're always moving and going forward. So times are changing, and now we're into technology, and who heard of a bracelet that is technology, you know, like, right. yes, you could still log on to the app and you don't need the bracelet, but this right. is the fun part, you know?
Right.
So that's what I'm, and then I'm in the middle of pitching a couple of shows that I put together. One of the shows is based off of me as a person in a Navy SEAL program. It's a story. I created a vlog.
I wouldn't limit it to that. But I would include everything else.
Yeah.
But let me close with this. Because we got to close. You know, everybody's got a thumbprint for, you know, and that's the beauty of stand-up comedy, because really you don't have any competition really in stand-up, because it's all about you telling your story, you know, your personality. I got to tell you, you got one hell of a freaking thumbprint. I mean, you really put yourself out there for such a different life. And, you know, and even the things that you didn't choose, like your ear, you know, but how you chose to handle that. I love that. I love you sharing your story. I love that you're a really good conversationalist. And I can't wait till you attach punchlines to your stories so you could see it in stand up. I see one woman show, you know, happening here. But anyways, I want to please tell everybody how they can find out more about you.
Yeah.
And I'm letting you guys know right now, we're going to get into on the Bullet Tour podcast 6 months from now. We're going to have you back, and we're going to talk about your whole adventure of getting kidnapped up in Big Bear.
It's an adventure. It's an adventure. Yeah. Sure.
Tell everybody how they can find out more about you.
So you can find out more about me on my website, GinaCazzazza.com. The vlog is there on training with the SEAL, and there's also the story of me getting kidnapped. All my short films and acting, some comedy is on there as well. Link to my bracelet company, and you can find my book there for signed copies. You could find my book on Amazon. You could find it at Barnes & Noble. It's available. And that's everything about me.
Wow, what a story. Gina, thank you so much for sharing. I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me. You're really fun to talk to.
Thanks
for all the questions. I appreciate it.
It's the beauty of the podcast. You get to pick and choose. Sometimes I thought we were going to talk about one thing, you know, but wow, this is a lot more. So thank you so much. And I look forward to having you tell your adventure story on Bullet Tour. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
That was stand-up comedian, rock and tour author, advocate of training with the Navy SEALs and paying for her to get kidnapped and many other things, Gina Cazzazza. Gina, here's a great quote for you. There's definitely an obstacle in developing a brand for yourself that people can rely on when you're so eclectic. Fred Durst. I'm glad I was able to find a great quote from Fred Durst. Thank you for joining us, and I look forward to hanging out with you all in the next episode. All right. Have you guys been to longshotleaders.com? That's where you can check out all of the guests and the bios and the backgrounds and more. Also, if you haven't done so already, subscribe to the podcast on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what we do, give us a good rating. Tell your family and friends to come by and listen. It's going to make you feel nice and toasty inside. Every week, we'll be delivering knowledge, creativity, inspiration, exasperation, perspiration. If it ends with a shun, basically, you're going to find it here. All right. Thank you for joining us. And in the great words of Bill Murray in the movie Caddyshack, friends for life, I say.